This is Amy, and you're listening to the Talkin' Appalachian podcast. April has been the most amazing month. Listen to what my April has looked like. We had the Cherokee documentary. I got to talk with Michael McDermott, the director of We Will Speak. That episode will be coming next week. So stay tuned for that. Make sure you subscribe where you get your podcasts so you won't miss it. But we talk about the Cherokee language and the revival of the Cherokee language. This is a beautiful documentary. I'm going to be sharing some excerpts from the documentary with his permission. And it's really interesting because that, plus a discussion with someone from Ireland about the revival of the Irish language, plus had a discussion with someone today from Scotland about the revival of Scots Gaelic. That all just came together in April. Then we had Ron Rash on campus a couple of weeks ago. Got to hear him read from The Caretaker and some poetry. That was wonderful. And then we had the amazing Barbara Kingsolver. And I know a lot of you are looking forward to that podcast episode. It was her last reading of Demon Copperhead, she said. She was marking that down as the very last one. She brought him back home because the story is set in Lee County, and we were in next door, Wise County. Really exciting to meet her and hear her read from that book. So last week we did an episode on the burial ground in the woods. I was with William Isom of Black in Appalachia, and we talked about some of the history of the burial ground that we found. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, you might want to listen to that one first, and this one will make more sense probably. But we'll try to fill in the gaps just in case you haven't listened to that one. I'm joined by my cousin, Dr. Angela Washington. I mentioned her in the previous episode because she helped me do some of the research on the family when I was trying to find out who owned the land, who was in the death portrait, who the people in the burial ground might have been, and if it was an enslaved community, who were they connected to? So Angela came on board. We share ancestors who owned the land. She was my Indiana cousin. And we grew up, you know, visiting each other. Her grandmother was my great-grandmother's sister. So we share a lot of stories. We have a lot of interests in common with this, but she comes at it also from a different perspective. Really happy to have her on board for this episode and to give you more details about some of the artifacts that we found and why they were so significant to this particular project. For more photos of the artifacts that Angela and I discuss in this episode, subscribe to our YouTube channel and click on the Community tab. To hear an essay on the entire story from beginning to end, go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/TalkinAppalachianPodcast, and subscribe there. You'll get excerpts of the essay, plus early access to episodes and bonus behind-the-scenes content. Thanks for listening, and remember to keep talking Appalachian.
During my research for my PhD, I stayed focused on health, the history of healthcare for African Americans, particularly in the city of Louisville. But I looked at all matters of disparity, particularly where racism plagued our healthcare system, and that's kind of been where my interest has stayed for the most part. All my research is sort of towards that, which is, you know. I love history. I fancy myself a historian. I don't know if I could claim that title yet, but I do love it. I love it. That's my favorite thing, is to be in old books, old papers, pictures.
Me too. And that's kind of how we reconnected. It's the reason we have so much good research about our family is thanks to your mom and your dad and your uncle.
They have. And I'm grateful for just the stories they tell me about that process even. They've gathered a lot of that data and put it in a GEDCOM file. And so that's always good. They put little stories in there. I don't know how much I've shared with you, but like there's a really good story about Josephus, which is my great-grandfather, when he had a vision of this horse, this white, snow-white horse during a snowstorm. They've put that story down. Like those kind of things they put in there. Uncle Ford, which is my grandfather's brother, when he went to Harlan to look for the 800 acres that Asa, our great-great-grandfather, owned, he came upon the cabin that he had had. That's gone, long gone, but this is like 1954, and he saw the cabin, and you know, so it's cool to have all that documented.
And that's the power of primary sources. I mean, that's what it can do for us, is fill in the gaps, you know?
Absolutely.
I turned to them when I started researching this old burial ground behind my granny's house in the woods. And then you came on board. And so I just want you to talk about your family's connection to that home place down below where the burial ground was and how you became interested in the research.
Asa Roop was born in Montgomery County, Virginia, and he was one of three illegitimate sons born to a lady named Nancy, a German family. They were like second generation German. And at some point, the oldest of those three boys, the illegitimate boys, moved to Lee County for work. And then he called his two brothers on over too. And Nancy came along with them. So Asa was one of the young, he was the middle brother. He was the middle child. And they came, and when they got to Lee County, Jonesville, it was a snowstorm. This is family folklore, snowstorm. And they needed some place to stay. And they sought out Maston Collier, who had a fairly large, I mean, I've seen pictures of it. It looks almost like a hotel house. And he ran a mill in town. And the family legend is that he had several slaves as well. And he must have, I guess, housed people coming in for work or whatever, because they stayed there and worked for him and then sort of stayed on and both married his daughters. So Asa then married Marianne and was gifted. Again, this is all family legend, gifted two slaves at their marriage. And this was, they married in like 1860. So just at the beginning of the Civil War. So right, probably right prior to, and again, family legend, Asa didn't want to fight the war anymore. He decided it was a lost cause, but Maston talked him into going back. And if he would go back, he would take his Confederate money at the end of the war. I think they all kind of saw the writing on the wall that it was going to end and the South was not going to win. And so he did. And you and I went down to the courthouse to look at the deed history on that land. And sure enough, it looks like possibly, I think we talked to somebody there that does surveying or does some kind of land surveying. And he's like, well, wow, that was a lot of money back then. It would make sense if it was Confederate money because it wasn't really worth anything after the war. So the land where the burial ground is on was bought by Asa, originally owned by Maston Collier. So that's kind of how it got to be his land. And then as the years went on, his daughter inherited it. And then your grandmother, your great grandmother, et cetera. Now your grandmother has that land. So,
and the only quote unquote proof, or we really don't have proof of Maston Collier's ownership of enslaved people, because I looked at tax records in Richmond. We went to the courthouse. Will Isom did all kinds of research. We only have the oral history. And we have the 1870 census, which put freed Black folks living on Maston Collier's property.
Because one with the last name Collier, I think.
One had the last name Collier. So all of our, you know, evidence of that is circumstantial, but pretty powerful nonetheless. I mean, it's a lot of inductive evidence that leans in that direction.
It does. And then there's the quilt or the coverlet. Before I really knew any of this, and I don't know when I found out, I was well into my adult years before I learned about all this history that had been apparently well-known history among the family. There was my grandfather's sister had a coverlet that she said was handed down to her from Marianne. So Marianne was the daughter of Maston Collier who married Asa and was inherited these two slaves. And the story was, is that the two slaves had made this coverlet for them. They called it a quilt, but it was really more of a coverlet, like a woven, not a hand patch thing, but like a woven fabric. And she had passed it on to Sally was her name. And Sally had it on a bed. She had moved to Florida and she had it on a bed and some puppies that she had tore it. And so she decided that it needed to be handed down. So she cut it into squares and gave one to like my mom, another one to my Aunt Jill, Roger's wife. I think Aunt Maisel may have got one. She handed it down to several of the descendants. That was the story, was that Marianne said these were from the slaves. They made this. So we still have pieces of that. You have one. I have one, a piece of that coverlet. And I think you had spoke to somebody about it and they said, yes, it definitely looks like it could be 1860s. Woven, you know.
Yes, I connected with a textile expert at Berea College, and he looked at pictures and he looked at the pattern, the way that it was woven, and he determined that it did date back to that time period and it was probable that plant dyes were used for the colors. So,
yeah,
very high probability that that story was accurate.
And that's the funny thing about history. Sometimes stories get kind of, they get mixed up and things get added or subtracted, but there's always some level of, you know, fact in there often. But I would love to think that Maston Collier was just a liberal and that he believed anybody should be able to have the freedom to work. And so that all these runaway slaves, he's like, yeah, come on, I'll let you have a job. And, you know, I'd love to think that way because we can't find... We can't find census records that show he was a slave owner. You know, historically, when you think about stories that are passed down, why would that be something? I guess that's my thought. Why would my family focus on the fact that they owned slaves? Like, why was that important? Other than I think they felt like it gave a status or showed a status. And that I'm going to be honest, a little ashamed of. That was something they felt important to pass down. Because growing up, we were fairly modest means. I don't want to say we were poor. My dad's very hardworking, but we were definitely working class. Family, I would say, is mostly, you know, very working class people. Nobody's of wealth, you know, that kind of thing. Why did that seem to be so important to them that they hang on to the fact that their ancestor was a slave owner? Like, that's interesting to me. You know what I mean?
The only time I ever heard that word was in reference to that burial ground. It was never... You know, there was a picture that hung on my great grandmother's wall, you know, the death portrait.
So yes.
The death scary portrait thing. That scared all of us, us children, because it hung in the bedroom where the children would stay when everyone was visiting. And I can't express how terrified I was of that picture because it's a picture of my great great grandma. I can't remember how many greats, but it's grandmother's standing and grandfather, Dal Russell, and my great-grandfather when he was a child standing behind a casket that's been propped up on a ladder-back chair.
Yeah.
And inside that casket is a 10-year-old child. And that was my great-grandfather's sister, Minnie. She died very young.
Meningitis. She died of meningitis. Yeah.
Horrible way to die.
Yeah.
A horrible, slow way to die. And so that was... another piece of evidence, because when I never knew who those people were besides who Minnie was. And I think back and I think, well, I didn't ask, but I mean, you don't ask questions when you're a child. You just don't. It doesn't, you don't care about that stuff. You don't care about the history. Owner of the land was Mary Roop.
Right. Mary Ann.
Who is standing in that photo. And that was pointed out to me when I first started the research, and it was amazing to me that she had been there all the time.
Yeah, we were scared. When we go stay with Ann Buck, we'd be like, I don't want to sleep in that room. It's creepy.
So she was the daughter of Maston Collier.
So Mary Ann was the wife of the daughter of Maston Collier and the wife of Asa, who ultimately inherited that property or bought it from Maston.
So her granddaughter, that Minnie was her granddaughter or great-granddaughter?
I believe that would have been her. Let me give it two thoughts. Hold on. It should have been her granddaughter. Yeah. And that makes sense. Same generation as like my grandfather coming. So yeah, that was a very scary portrait. So that's kind of an interesting, because the slave graves, when I was a little girl, and I remember this, but nobody remembers it but me. And I remember it very vividly. I was probably 6, 7, visiting Aunt Buck's house, your great grandmother's, where the slave graves were. And I recall my brother, my older brother, who's about 10 years older than me, going to look for an Indian burial ground. That's how he called it. And I wanted to go. And he's like, no, he was going with another cousin. And when I ask him about it, he doesn't recall that. But I do remember him saying there's a burial ground up on the hill. That's what I remember. But he does not recall doing that. Then you came along and said that your grandmother said it was a burial ground. So I'm like, so there was a burial ground. So that's twice that we heard about this burial ground. And then you kind of came upon it happenstance, right? She made a reference to it.
Well, when I was little, we all went out there tromping through the woods, adults and kids, and they showed it to us. And that was when I was little. And then I think at some point when I was older, we went tromping through the woods again and saw it. And then much, much, much later, I was in that writing workshop and I started thinking about it. and thought, no, wait a minute. You know, I've been looking at these graves. And like I said, I was going to make a point about that death portrait that I've lost. So I'll come back to it. The only time I ever heard the word slave was in reference to that burial ground. It was never in reference to any people. Mary in that picture, that was never. I like to think that another possible version is the one you described. I love to think that maybe Maston was someone who just embraced people coming and working for him, and that maybe they just meant these were formerly enslaved people, or, you know, that's what I like to think, because that part of family history, you know, either they were ashamed or they didn't associate that burial ground at all with the family. Cheney, you know, my great grandmother told my grandmother that there was a cornfield down below and that they would hoe up to the graves, but never go inside the burial ground. Never, I guess, maybe out of reverence or whatever.
But to put it in perspective, though, since you've discovered those and you had the sonar or whatever done, found that there are similar type graves kind of scattered all over that place. Honestly, like, there's some down the road. There's Minnie, the girl in the portrait, the death portrait. She's buried with just a little rock, but it's most of them are near other proper cemeteries. At Maston Collier's old cemetery, which sits now in a cow field, there are some rocks kind of out away from the main cemetery plot, which makes you think, okay, these were either babies, poor people, enslaved, or possibly enslaved people. But the thing that's unique about that site up on the hill, which is now at your grandma's place, is that it's laid out in a different manner than the others. And it's definitely a community of graves, I guess, is one way of looking at it, as opposed to a scattering. So for instance, down the road, Uncle Keith's house, he's got about 4 stones out in the pasture that look like probably set up as grave sites, but they're just like 4 random stones. What you have is like a circular pattern, like a pattern as if it's a proper quote unquote cemetery, and not just someone, you know, burying their loved ones out next to the house or close to the house.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that we did the GP, the ground penetrating radar, was because I got a little grant and we had a physicist come in and read the ground with that, because so many of the stones had been toppled by trees, fallen over, gotten moved. And so we wanted to see how they were laid out in the ground. And there's definitely an organized system of how the bodies are buried. And he also identified clusters, like you said, which indicated families being buried relatively close together. But the fact that it, and this is where I drew on Lynn Rainville's research from her book, Hidden History. And I actually interviewed Lynn about this cemetery. She's an archaeologist who studies this very thing. She said the fact that it is away from the main homestead, away from the homestead, up on a hill, covered in vinca, in the woods, it aligns with all of the characteristics of the burial ground of enslaved community, because that's generally how those burial grounds are positioned or placed or started. So I think that's very interesting too.
That cemetery plot was probably started back when it was Maston's property, because Maston's house would have been a little further than Asa's. So Asa ended up building a cabin there, kind of down at the foot of that hill. Barn sits and all that was Asa's property, or Asa's home, where he built his home. So it makes you think maybe it even started prior to that, when Maston either let them use his property or whatever was going on, but when that property belonged to Maston, because his house is a little bit of a ways.
Yeah.
So it would have been fairly far away from the main house.
So I had to reflect on it a lot, you know, finding this out. And, you know, it's complicated because, you know, you talk to family and some people are like, just let the past be the past.
Bygones be bygones.
Let the dead stay buried. Let's don't dig up bones, you know, excuse the pun. But, you know, I had to really rethink growing up in Lee County and what I was taught, the absence of this history, what I wasn't taught, what we didn't know. And it's been an interesting experience personally.
Yeah. And I think just as Americans, we think about, I think it's been taught, I don't want to say that it was ever formally taught, but you just assume that region didn't have slaves because it didn't have big plantation homes and that kind of thing. someone recently posted on Facebook, I don't know if it was the Lee County Facebook group or if it was the Civil War, the guy that does the Civil War, Jonesville battle, but they posted a map that showed the quantity or the percentage of enslaved people. And it was something like 14% in Lee County. It was actually pretty high.
Yeah.
And, you know, now there's been a lot more research to show that there's a huge Black influence at Black American slaved or, you know, or free in that region. We know that. So, and how to get there. I go back to the statement again, it seems odd to me that someone would pass that piece of information down. Now it's shameful. I don't like that people know that my ancestors owned slaves. Like and as you know, I have biracial children.
If they did,
like great-granddaddy.
If they did, we didn't prove it.
Yeah, if they did.
But
yeah, it's like, it's not a source of like pride. It's actually like, oh my God, how shameful. But at some point it must have been for that to be something they find important to pass down. So, you know, unfortunately that's human nature to want to have something that gives you status or whatever. And I guess at that time, that was the thing that made you, wasn't like there were fancy cars or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was your home, owning slaves, having, you know, financial wealth, I guess. Yeah. I would love to know more about the graves. I don't know that I'll ever stop wondering about the people who were buried there. Who were they? What were their lives like? I mean, you just think about, you can go to a gravesite. I don't know if you now you've seen them. You can actually get a thing to go on somebody's grave that gives like a little QRS code and you can like see a whole
QR
like
code
video. Yeah, QR code. And you can see a whole video of their life or, you know, little snippets. Wouldn't that be great to just see like who were they and what was their life like? Were they unhappy? Did they have happy times? Did they have any good times? I mean, you think about slavery and it had to have been brutal, but did they get any enjoyment at life at all? Like you wonder that.
Or they emancipated and then buried there. You know, we don't, we have no idea. You know, we had an approximation of the, but then of course the family folklore called it the slave cemetery. But then again, that could have still been an enslaved community that was buried there after. We just don't know for sure. But yeah, that would be wonderful if we could find out more. That's been the frustrating thing. And Will and I talked about this, you know, that there's this in African-American genealogy, it's called the wall there, you know, prior to emancipation, they were recorded by on the census by date, by age, sex and skin color.
And that might get a nickname, first name or something at the most. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bessie or whatever.
So that makes it hard
to
trace.
It totally does. So we probably will never know. I will always wonder.
So I did have it registered with the state.
Awesome.
Will prodded and I kept forgetting. So he was like, one condition, I'll come on your podcast if you send in that registration. So
good.
I finally did. So I had it registered, but I went back recently we went back recently together, and it is, the woods just takes it back in a matter of,
earth has reclaimed itself.
It reclaimed it. I mean, it was very hard for us to find.
Registering it though will keep it from being damaged or anything done to it in the future. Like it'll always be known to be a cemetery
makes it a cemetery so that it is protected by law as a cemetery. But I want to sneak in this little story because it was so fascinating to find. You and I and some other family went back down there last year and we were rummaging through the barn. What you found?
Asa was the guy who actually bought the property from Maston. Asa was the Civil War soldier who didn't want to go, who didn't want to go back. Asa built a cabin and a corn crib and a barn, all there at the foot of those slave graves, those graves that we assume are enslaved people's graves. And all that's left really is the corn crib. So we were down there for the how manyth time, by the way? I feel like we've been down there.
We had been
so
there before.
Yeah, we were just there a couple years ago and digging around. And I just literally started sticking my fingers in places that we should have. I mean, you know, it was like, who knows what? But I saw what looked like a piece of wood, a chunk of wood. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. And I go to pick it up and it's actually a Bible, an old Bible from Milam was his last name.
Yeah, he was Russell Milam's brother.
And he, I guess, I'm wondering if he stayed there. And he said, like, maybe they let him stay in the corn crib or something. It was like 1932. He had wrote an entry into it and said that he had gotten that Bible in 1932 and had, I can't remember if he put much more in there, but that probably had been laying in there.
For 90 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
It is crazy. And it was, and it wasn't,
and it's still intact.
It was intact. I mean, it was a little bit rat chewed, but it didn't have water damage or anything like that. And then you found out, you found a photo of him.
Yeah. My mama had,
a photo of him with Chaney, and he had been in the Spanish-American War.
Yes, he had. Yes. So a kind of cool little tidbit. It's like he probably was the last one to touch it before I touched it, which is just so neat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a whiskey bottle.
A liquor bottle of some sort. And then,
So he had his bottle in his bottle.
But the time before that, when we were there together, I found one of those rings for the cow. Remember that nose ring thing that goes in the cow's nose? I found that. And so I hang on to those little tidbits because I don't know, did Asa have them? Did somebody else have them? But it's just... I just feel connected. I've always felt connected to Asa, and I don't know what it is about him that has always had me intrigued. Maybe it was the stories of him as a kid about, you know, he certainly tried to make something of himself. He owned about 800 acres over in Harlan. And ultimately, he divorced his wife, or she divorced him. I'm not sure who divorced who, but he had TB. And so he went to Missouri thinking that that would be better. The climate would be better for his tuberculosis. And he died out there. And Mary Ann, his wife, divorced him and married a guy named Skidmore. And then the properties were all kind of divided up amongst children. He had... 9-10 kids. I'd have to go back to my genealogy to look, but he had several children. My grandfather's father was the youngest, so Josephus. But interesting that he was always a topic, even though, like, my dad never met Asa. It was his great-grandfather, but he had never met him. I mean, he had died long before my dad was ever born. But for some reason, he was just like a legend. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't know what it is about him. Like, what was it about him?
Well, sort of like Rainwater Ramsey on my side.
Yeah.
That was how he was always talked about because...
Like a legend. Yes.
Mamma talked about him too. You know, when I interviewed Rick Bragg, Southern author, I told him about all of this because about the time he came here to campus, I was neck deep in this stuff. And I told him about it and he goes, it sounds like you need to talk to some ghosts. You know, and it feels like that's what we do when we when we stick our hands into places we shouldn't stick our hands.
And we don't like get bit.
They talk back to us right through these documents and through the stones and through the pages that we look at in the basements of courthouses. And so I think it's just, and I know there are so many more people doing this work, and it's just really been a transformative experience. That I don't want to be over. Maybe it'll just keep going on and on and on.
There's still so many questions.
Yeah.
There's still so many questions. It's like, please keep showing me. Like, keep showing me what I need to know or like what I should know. Like, there's still so many things. So I think we go back to that barn again and we'll find something even new.
We'll find something else. Maybe
when it falls over, we might find something under it. Who knows? Anything that we can find is just, it is like talking to ghosts.